Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. FedEx offers fast delivery, more visibility, simple returns, and weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. population on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. With FedEx, you get picture proof of delivery, ensuring you always know where your package is. Returns are simple with packageless and paperless returns. Plus, FedEx Ground is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. So, what are you waiting for? See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.
McDonald's is warning customers that it recently experienced a production glitch that caused their buns to have potentially come into contact with nuts. Or as New Yorkers call it, a subway ride.
From 30 Rockefeller Plaza in New York City, please enjoy this podcast edition of Late Night with Seth Meyers. Today, Seth talks to Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author Ronan Farrow. Then, exclusively for this podcast, Farrow sticks around for a few more questions backstage at Studio AG. But first, a closer look.
The White House is dealing with new revelations involving the president's fixer, Michael Cohen, and questions about its cruel policy of separating immigrant families. For more on this, it's time for a closer look. On Thursday, Trump was in Indiana campaigning for Republican Senate candidate Mike Braun. Now, Trump doesn't exactly have a great track record campaigning for Republicans down ballot, mainly because Trump's shtick only works for him. We saw that dynamic play out in Pennsylvania, where Democrat Connor Lamb won in an overwhelmingly Republican district when Trump campaigned for the GOP candidate Rick Saccone. Saccone tried unsuccessfully to borrow some of Trump's favorite talking points.
I want to thank President Trump. As I said before, if President Trump's in your corner, how can you lose? He's the best man you could ask. Anyone could ask to be in your corner. As any good businessman knows, you work on a deal, you work on a deal, but there comes a time to close the deal. This is the time to close the deal. We got 2 days left. Are you going to help me on Tuesday? Let's close this deal.
Whoa. You got to ramp into the screen, buddy. I don't know if he won any votes with that pitch, but if there are any birds in the rafters, he definitely scared them away. He went from normal congressional candidate to full mattress salesman in half a second. But Trump was apparently not deterred by Saccone's loss because he was right back at it in Indiana, campaigning against Democratic Senator Joe Donnelly, and the crowd indulged in one of their favorite chants.
This November, Indiana will face an important choice. You can send a really incredible swamp person back to the Senate, like Joe Donnelly, or you can send us Republicans like Mike Braun to drain the swamp.
I'm sorry, but after all your scandals, the phrase drain the swamp is now devoid of all meaning. You might as well chant, "We like Ike," or "Brooklyn Dodgers." Trump's cabinet has had one corruption scandal after another, and his personal fixer was literally selling access to the president. Trump didn't drain the swamp. He bottled it and sold it as Dr. Trump's miracle healing elixir. In fact, in his next sentence, Trump actually claimed that his administration was fighting corruption.
Under my administration, we're fighting against the lobbyists, the special interests, and the corrupt Washington politics.
That's right. He fought corrupt Washington politics and replaced it with the only thing that's worse, corrupt New York politics. Seriously. Washington corruption used to be K Street lobbyists handing off bribes in parking garages. Now it's shady ambulance chasers with mob ties funneling money through real estate and taxi medallions. I mean, look at these guys. They look like they should be playing cards in the back of a butcher shop waiting for someone to call them and say, it's done. If they weren't aides to the president, they'd have competing strip clubs outside of Secaucus. Of course, last week we found out that the secret shell company set up by Trump's personal attorney, Michael Cohen, to pay off porn star Stormy Daniels also took in millions of dollars from a firm linked to a Russian oligarch and major companies like AT&T and the pharmaceutical giant Novartis. In fact, we now know that Cohen was basically cold-calling companies to try to profit off of Trump's presidency.
According to multiple people, shortly after President Trump's win, the president's fixer, Cohen, was aggressively pitching himself to potential clients.
Cohen reminded potential clients of his proximity to the world's most powerful man.
One Republican strategist describes Cohen's pitch this way. I don't know who's been representing you, but you should fire them all. I'm the guy you should hire. I'm closest to the president. I'm his personal lawyer.
Man, it's really sad when someone can believably say the person who's closest to you is not your wife or your kids, but your lawyer. I'm sure Trump has said to Eric, of course I love you. You're like a lawyer to me. On his health insurance form. I guarantee you on his health insurance form, Trump's emergency contact probably just says, outside legal counsel. And that pitch was apparently very lucrative for Cohen. Novartis, for example, paid him a stunning $100,000 per month for an entire year. By comparison, according to the Daily Beast, during all of 2017, Novartis's formal payments to outside lobbying firms averaged under $12,000 a month, less than an eighth of what it paid Cohen for the better part of a year in which the company says he did exactly zero work. Wow, over $1 million for no work. That explains Novartis's new drug, Cohentril. You take it when you're not sick because it doesn't do a thing. The warning. Warning. Its side effect is Robert Mueller. But if there's ever any question about your credibility when it comes to alleged secret payments made through a shell company to your personal fixer, there's only one man you want defending you. And that's the ghost of Colonel Klink, Rudy Giuliani. Now, when the news about Cohen's secret payments first broke last week, Giuliani emerged from his coffin in the basement of a Grimaldi's and started calling reporters to try to explain. But he didn't exactly have his story straight. When Giuliani was first asked if Trump knew about the payments to Cohen, Giuliani told Time, I have no idea. I doubt it. He then told the AP he knew nothing about it. Then he added, I haven't talked to him in detail except for the first day it came out. When it first came out, he was surprised. Rudy tries out different answers like a janitor with too many keys. He never heard of Michael Cohen. He heard of him, but he doesn't like him. He's his best friend. Oh. So Trump wants us to believe he didn't know anything about his personal lawyer selling access to his administration, just like he wanted us to believe he didn't know anything about the hush payment to Stormy Daniels. But if you replace Donald Trump with Hillary Clinton and essential consultants with the Clinton Foundation, Trump might have a very different take on whether this constitutes an illegal pay-for-play scheme.
Hillary is the one who engaged in a corrupt pay-for-play scheme at the State Department. And now there are 5 FBI probes into the Clinton Foundation.
She engaged in corrupt pay-for-play at the State Department.
Access and favors were sold for cash. It's called pay for play.
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 Pay for play. Pay for play. It's illegal.
Pay for play.
It's called pay for play.
Pay for play. You can say it so many different ways. Of course, here at NBC, we say, pay for play. Although, pay for play was probably Michael Cohen's sales pitch.
You give me money, I give you access to the president. It's called pay for play. It's super legal, and I should know I went to law school in the back of a van.
The Cohen scandal is yet another embarrassment for a White House that has no shortage of things to be embarrassed about. On Friday, Chief of Staff John Kelly added one more thing to that pile with his comments on Trump's immigration policy. Kelly was asked specifically about the Trump administration's cruel new plan to separate the children of undocumented immigrants from their parents and said this.
Family separation stands as a pretty tough deterrent.
Could be a tough deterrent.
a much faster turnaround on asylum seekers.
Even though people say that's cruel and heartless to take a mother away from her children.
Yeah, I think cruel and heartless, I wouldn't put it quite that way. The children will be taken care of.
Yeah.
They'll put into foster care or whatever.
Foster care or whatever? Foster care is bad enough, but what's whatever? They'll go into foster care or, you know, coal mines. They'll be fine. Of course, for the Trump administration, every day brings new frontiers of cruelty and heartlessness, whether it's separating children from their parents or mocking an ailing senator and war hero for his opposition to torture.
A White House official mocked Senator John McCain's brain cancer diagnosis at an internal meeting on Thursday, a day after the Arizona Republican announced his opposition to President Trump's nominee for CIA Director Gina Haspel. Special Assistant Kelly Sadler made the derisive comments during a closed-door White House meeting of about two dozen communications staffers on Thursday morning. Quote, it doesn't matter. He's dying anyway.
Wow. That is disgusting. And the Trump administration is absolutely horrified and saddened that that comment got out.
When one of your colleagues in the White House communications shop decided at a meeting to joke that John McCain's opinion doesn't matter because he's dying of brain cancer, do you think that was kind?
Look, I wasn't in the meeting. I didn't hear the comment.
Okay, but you've heard the comment now. Pardon me. Was it kind?
Right, but I don't know if the comment was even made or not. I can't confirm it. I wasn't in the meeting.
So you're denying that she said it?
No, I'm not denying it. I'm saying okay. I wasn't in the meeting, and I can't talk about it.
Well, nobody's really denied it. She called Meghan McCain to apologize. So it sounds like she said it. Was it kind?
Again, I wasn't in the meeting. I don't know if it was said or not. All I can say is we don't comment on internal private meetings in the White House.
Man, you know it's bad when you're getting grilled by Fox and Friends. That's where Trump staffers go to feel good about themselves. That's like getting grilled by your therapist. Are you or are you not afraid of commitment? Answer the question. In fact, White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders was apparently so upset that the comment got out that she called a meeting to talk about it. According to Axios, the visibly upset and furious Sanders told the group, I am sure this conversation is going to leak too, and that's just disgusting, according to a source in the room. Sanders' prediction came true. What follows below is a leak from that very intense meeting yesterday, according to five sources in the room. Amazing, she had a meeting about leaking that she predicted would leak, and the prediction about leaking leaked from five sources. At this point, Sanders should just start live-streaming meetings by strapping a GoPro to her head. This is Trump's government, cruelly separating children from their parents, mocking an ailing senator, and on top of that, Trump's personal fixer was calling up companies and saying,
let's close this deal!
There's been a closer look. Our guest is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist and a contributing writer for The New Yorker. His new book, War on Peace, The End of Diplomacy and the Decline of American Influence, is available now. Please welcome back to the show, Ronan Farrow, everybody. Welcome back.
As I live and breathe, I'm back.
And congratulations on a Pulitzer.
Thank you.
You did not have one of those last time you were here.
I did not. I do not take that lightly. A lot of very brave sources did some very tough stuff, so.
And I want to talk about the work you did to win the Pulitzer, but I also want to talk about this book that is separate from that. And I know, you know, when we do a show about breaking news, we have to scramble and cover things last minute.
You do an incredible job.
Well, thank you.
I love a fake press briefing, right?
But you...
You ask harder questions than the actual press board.
I know. Thank you very much. Thanks for pointing that out. But this is a book. This is a book. And books have to be done a lot longer in advance than something that I would do. And you actually, in real time, sort of had to cover the Tillerson firing because this is about Secretary of State's and diplomacy. And did you interview Tillerson after he was fired for the book or before?
Tillerson, if he had any logic, knew that he was going to be fired on some level. Maybe that's why he's so frank in this book. I mean, he basically says, I didn't know what I was doing. I wasn't experienced enough for it. I set out to interview every living Secretary of State. I got there in the end. But the problem with writing about this administration is people are fired every 5 minutes.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's like rolling off the presses, and I'm like, wait, stop the machines. I need to add Mike Pompeo to this book.
And you managed to.
And I did.
That's interesting. Again, it is very forthright and frank, the way Tillerson talks about. It's almost like an exit interview where he admits he deserved to get fired. Were you surprised?
He lays a lot of blame on this White House. I was not surprised because it is apparent to anyone looking at the State Department, which I was for this book, that it's become something of a dumpster fire, which is sad because there are brave men and women serving there. And, you know, what I lay out in this book is it's unglamorous work. It's not work that people always understand as much as what the military does, but it really saves lives.
And I do want to point out that you do not lay all the blame on the feet of Republicans insofar as the state of the State Department right now, that both Republicans and Democrats have a problem talking about the importance of diplomacy vis-a-vis the importance of the military.
Yeah, so, you know, these are the people that, yes, stamp passports and stuff, but also screen dangerous people and prevent them from coming into the country. They're the people who save you if you're kidnapped abroad. They're the people who cut the high-level political deals that keep our servicemen and women out of the line of fire. They're really important. But because, you know, they're not on the front lines with guns making things go boom, people on campaign trails invariably kind of decry them as dusty bureaucrats who don't get anything done. And that is true of both Democrats and Republicans. The Clinton administration was terrible on this. They slashed and burned spending on diplomacy. It was really bad for us around the world. It is happening now to a new extreme. But yeah, this is about both parties. And a lot of Republicans are in this book saying this is a huge problem. Colin Powell saying we're mortgaging our future right now with this.
You went and interviewed an Afghani general. Is that Dostum?
General Dostum, who is typically described as a warlord, although in this book he says he is a peace lord.
Oh, nice rebranding.
Shortly before admitting to dumping hundreds, maybe thousands of Taliban prisoners into a mass grave.
Oh, my goodness.
I don't know how that squares with the peace lord thing.
And what was your takeaway insofar as how his rise to power in Afghanistan reflects on U.S. diplomacy?
So one of the interesting consequences of kicking the diplomats and the negotiators and the peacemakers out of the room is you end up with policy that's made much more out of the Pentagon and the CIA, and there are great people there, and that's an important part of how we do business. But when it's the only part of how we do business, you end up with relationships like the one we have with General Dostum, which is we gave him a ton of guns after 9/11. He went after the Taliban, but then we're kind of stuck with him. And now he's the vice president of Afghanistan. And I chronicle how multiple administrations covered up for his human rights abuses, including this mass grave, which he kind of admits to, that his commanders did it. And, you know, you meet him, and it's pretty quickly apparent that he's not necessarily the kind of guy you want to be lying down with.
Yet, when you met him, he had a reindeer.
He did have a reindeer.
Yeah, okay.
He kind of,
can you explain how an Afghani warlord ends up with a reindeer?
So I don't know if you can see in this picture, but there's like kind of flashing Christmas tree lights everywhere. There's tchotchkes around, like porcelain figurines of horseback fighters, which is what he does. He has a sword and he's on horseback, like cutting heads off and stuff. And you know, this is like his warlord chic thing, and I guess it fits that he comes in with a reindeer, and he gestures to it like Vanna White or something, like here's the reindeer. And you know, there's guys with guns behind him, so you don't want to offend him. And it's a very nice reindeer.
Yeah. And it's not the reindeer's fault.
I mean,
he didn't choose the...
But very sharp antlers thrashing around.
Oh, so
I'm like, you know, dodging the antlers and saying, well, what general, what a lovely deer that is.
Yeah. Do you think he was, because you were an American, he's like, oh, I know how I'll put him at ease. I'll show him the reindeer.
Yeah, I think that's right.
It worked.
I felt
very
soon.
You're like, this is home.
Yeah.
I want to talk about, obviously, diplomacy is playing a role to some degree with North Korea right now. There is, it seems like, perhaps progress happening via the Trump administration and this it's so crazy that it might just work strategy of calling, Kim Jong-un Rocket Man and being very aggressive. Do you think there's a chance that this crazy sort of backdoor insane diplomacy might work?
I talked to all of the players in North Korean diplomacy over the last, 20 years in this book, and I tell the story of Chris Hill, who was the lead diplomat the last time we tried this under Bush. What all of these experts say is it's not necessarily that there's no place for diplomacy by angry, insane tweet, but you got to accompany that with some experts also saying, hey, here are the pitfalls. Here's where if you go into this meeting and say the wrong thing, maybe it will accidentally legitimize them as a nuclear power, which you don't want to do. Here's where we failed last time. Here's how to embed this in a long-term strategy. And that just so clearly isn't happening, Seth. And look, the time will tell how this pans out with the current efforts on North Korea. But just today, in the last hour or two, we saw that, like, maybe that summit is going to fall through. There's threats from North Korea. They're pulling out of certain talks with the South. So it's going to be a long haul till we know the consequences, and you need diplomats steering that.
I wish it wasn't such high stakes, because there is something interesting about watching Donald Trump deal with someone who's exactly as Trumpian as he is, in far as, you know, we're going to have this summit, and then that guy wakes up and is like, I don't want to have the summit anymore. You have the summit.
Well, I want to see it as, like, you know, like a multicam sitcom on CBS.
Yes.
I don't want to see it on the world stage of nuclear weapons.
Right. I would like to see it as, like, a simulation, just to see. Do you think that, you know, because, again, we're dealing with people who I don't think are thinking it through as far as what it's going to be 10 moves down the line with both Kim Jong-un and the president. But is the Iran deal, is the ripping up an Iran deal, does that work against the credibility of the United States making a similar deal with a different country?
Hugely. What every single person involved in diplomacy with either of these countries agrees on is it sends a chilling effect signal to the North Koreans for us to unilaterally pull out of the Iran deal. Why is any rogue state looking at coming to the table to broker a deal ever going to consider doing that if they know that we're just going to back down from our commitments immediately?
Yeah. Do you think... Do you think that... I want to talk... Could you write at length about how heated the negotiations were during the Iran deal and how John Kerry was so loud in the hotel room trying to make these negotiations that everybody could hear him through the walls?
Literally, everyone could hear the shouting. People are, like, breaking bones, literally breaking bones. There's a career diplomat named Wendy Sherman who broke a finger and a nose, and it's like, slow down, Wendy, stop running around. I don't know how that happened. John Kerry broke a femur because he, like, had a fight and then went out to bike to clear his head, which is, he's in the Alps. So he's, like, Alps biking.
Never angry bike in the Alps.
Never angry bike in the Alps. I guess if you're John Kerry and you're too far from the coast to windsurf,
you gotta
bike in the Alps.
Take different things, yeah.
But, yeah, he, like, was, you know, launched off of his bike and broke a femur. Literally sweat and blood went into this deal. And here's the thing, Seth. Diplomacy, when it works, looks imperfect. It's about compromise. You look at the great peace deals in this country's history, which I do in this book. I promise that's less boring than it sounds. That they're full of compromise. And likely any deal we get with North Korea is also going to be full of compromise. It'll focus on some narrow band of their activity, like their nuclear proliferation. And that's okay. That's how you do successful diplomacy. The signal we are sending stepping away from the table on Iran is we do not compromise as a nation. And that's not good for our safety.
Don't you think that's one of the problems with the kind of deals this president wants? Because his business career has been, here's the deal, you give me everything I want, and then I don't pay you. So... Like, he seems to be a man without compromise on all levels, and so I don't quite know how he can walk to the table with anyone of right mind who would think that they're going to get anything out of it.
I don't know if he thinks he can, like, pull a Trump University Ponzi scheme thing here, but that's not how international diplomacy works.
That makes sense. I want to talk about your incredible reporting on the Weinstein scandal, which is what you won your Pulitzer for, and you absolutely... Yeah. You
cheer for those sources. Well, they went through hell, and I think they're finally being heard.
Well, that, and again, there's this interesting thing because, you know, due to the absolute devastating nature of the crimes, you have one Harvey Weinstein and you have just, you know, a litany of victims. Do you think there's too much focus on the perpetrator is more than the victims in these cases?
Yeah, I mean, one of the most common questions I get is, like, what's Harvey Weinstein up to? Is he at a spa? Is he in sex rehab? And I'm like, I don't know. I'm not reporting on that. I'm trying to tell the stories of survivors who haven't been heard for decades, literally.
Yeah.
Thank you. It was an overdue spotlight on the actual allegations and the people living through the hell of these stories, and I'd like to keep the spotlight there.
You turned around and wrote a piece just a couple weeks ago that led to Eric Schneiderman resigning. I don't understand quite how you have the bandwidth to be doing all this incredible work. I'm
no
in
sleep,
awe
Seth.
Of you. No,
no
sleep.
Sleep.
Yeah. I mean, it seems as though the depths of how many people from so many positions, somebody like Eric Schneiderman, who obviously painted himself as a champion for women's rights and had this other awful, horrifying personality. Can you still be surprised, or is your capacity to be shocked by the behavior of these men just gone away?
I get the "are you surprised" question a lot, too. I don't know that surprised is the right word. I'm horrified by it, like mm-hmm. anyone reading these stories. And, you know, when claims are as heavily corroborated as the ones brought forward by these women about Eric Schneiderman, it becomes apparent that you got to tell the story, you know, no matter how much it seems at odds with the guy's reputation. I guess in that sense, it is surprising because he was such a champion of women's rights.
There was a lot written about how long it took for the Weinstein story to break, and you actually went back and used reporting from some of the people who came close but didn't quite get it across the finish line in terms of getting these stories published. Dave Carr, is that mm-hmm. correct? And Ken Aletta.
Yeah.
What was it like going back and working with their both their reporting and, in the case of Ken, getting to talk to him?
It was an incredibly moving experience. Look, at a time when I had spent months and months in rooms with executives saying, this is not a story, you know, pack it up, why won't you just give up on this? To have fellow reporters who got close over the course of 20 years almost say, yeah, no, this is real. We came really close. We wanted to get this and we couldn't. And to even have someone like Ken Aletta, wonderful New Yorker writer, share his notes, which corroborated things I was looking at. And as you said, David Carr, who died still wanting to break this story, and I documented how he was being smeared and intimidated, as so many reporters were in this process. Literally the ghosts of the past kind of rising up to help with this, and that was a lifeline. Journalism is a wonderful profession. It's the only constitutionally protected profession that we have, and people are generous in it by and large.
That's so nice to hear.
Yeah.
And I can't thank you enough for the work you've done this year and in previous years, and just keep it up, and we really need you right now.
Thanks
so much. Always so good to see you.
Thank you for the good work,
everybody. Thank you, buddy. War on Peace is available now.
Hi, this is Henry from Late Night. I'm here with Ronan Farrow.
Hi, guys.
Pulitzer Prize winner.
Thank you.
New Yorker, contributing writer.
Yep.
Best-selling author, diplomat, lawyer. Goes on and on and on.
Not a very good lawyer, but I do pay my bar dues. I mean, I haven't practiced in a while. I barely practiced.
When did you go to law school again? What years were this?
I graduated 2009 mm-hmm. from a small law school in New Haven, Connecticut.
Anyone in particular?
Yeah, you know.
And then straight to the State Department.
Yeah, exactly.
What drew you to the State Department originally?
I had a wild opportunity to go off basically to war, to go to Afghanistan and Pakistan with Richard Holbrooke,
right.
Who had made peace in Bosnia, and this turned out to be his last mission, and that's a big chunk of what I write about in the book, War on Peace.
Yeah, for the people who don't know about Richard Holbrooke, he was just incredible larger-than-life figure, and it was just so interesting reading about him. He seems like an incredible diplomat, and also, as you say, like a pain in the ass a lot of the time.
Yeah, huge pain in the ass. Massive ego, very sharp elbows, made enemies everywhere he went. But I also loved him, and he was profoundly loyal and generationally singular intellect, and really believed in the power of America to make peace, not just war.
Right. And you served during the Obama administration. You make a really interesting distinction between the first Obama term and the second Obama term. Can you kind of explain how diplomacy played a different role maybe in each 4 years?
So there's a number of Obama inner circle officials who are very frank in this book, kind of doing a mea culpa about how in the first term,
frank.
Yeah, saying that there was a culture of celebrity generals is a phrase that Ben Rhodes uses, one of Obama's foreign policy guys, and that, you know, diplomats like Richard Holbrooke often didn't have a seat at the table. And it's easy, I think, for a new president to be overwhelmed by a system where there's much more money and much more prestige on the military side, and where there's these giant military figures who command so much respect. And it's actually quite hard for civilians to be heard in that atmosphere. And in the second Obama term, these officials also talk about a course correction where they spent a few years doubling down on diplomacy and investing in, you know, the Iran deal, the thaw in relations with Cuba, the Paris Climate Change Accord. And very rapidly, you saw pretty good results in deals like that.
Yeah, and then all of those deals kind of dissolved.
Well, right. So now it's all being just torn down completely.
And that's what seems so interesting reading this book and thinking about it in the Trump era, how there are these hard-fought battles for diplomacy and how quickly those deals can go away.
Yeah, it's a precarious and delicate and precious thing, a deal like the Iran deal,
right,
which is imperfect and narrow in its focus, but also was working in containing Iran. And by walking away from that, not only have we created a new threat in the form of Iran and what's going to happen next there, but also we've sent this signal to North Korea
right.
and any other rogue state that I think will deter our ability to get deals elsewhere.
Yeah. How did reporting this book differ from reporting for a magazine article? I know this took much longer. Did you use different skills, different sources, or obviously different sources? Did you use different kind of tactics to get the story out?
It's a different medium in that actually the writing, strangely, can be a lot more fun in the book. Mm-hmm. And people have kind of commented on that, and I'm happy to see that so many people have pointed out that it reads like a novel almost.
I think, yeah.
I'm interested in getting your thoughts. I, as a writer, I think I'm naturally kind of have a colorful voice with a lot of descriptive mm-hmm. detail and a sense of place and time and characters' motivations. Yeah. And I wanted it to read like fiction, except for the fact that it happens to be fact. And yeah. I think you can do that when you have hundreds of pages and a medium you control completely. And if you're doing a white hot sensitive news piece mm-hmm. where people's lives hang in the balance, there's a lot less room. It's very pressurized. And particularly with these New Yorker investigations, we strip back the language really intensely. And there's a certain beauty and power in that, but it's a different art form.
Yeah. I mean, they really do. These characters in the book read like larger than life fictional characters because it seems like they were. I mean, you talk about Richard Holbrooke, General Joe Stum, many members of the Trump administration. Mm-hmm. I mean, an Exxon CEO that suddenly becomes Secretary of State. When you step back, I mean, it is kind of a wild thing.
I do all the voices in the audiobook. No, seriously, I do like Rex Tillerson's accent.
What's
in the
your
audiobook.
Rex Tillerson?
there's a moment where I say to him, like, does it make you anxious that there are all these unfilled positions across the State Department? He says, I don't get anxious.
I underline that part.
Yeah.
And then, speaking of voices of secretaries of state, you must do a Kissinger.
Oh, my God. My Kissinger's not great. I try. I just kind of, he goes very low, and he says, it is one great American myth that you can always try something new.
That's quite good. That is quite good. How was recording the audiobook?
Exhausting. You know, you're in the booth for like 20 hours. Mm-hmm. So I was, and I'm breaking all these other stories and doing all these other things. And so I, I did it in LA and New York mostly. And I did it with Audible, and they were lovely to work with. Uh-huh. And you should get it in addition to the print book, everyone.
How much money did you just make for that?
Almost nothing.
I'm just kidding.
No, seriously.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's not like the audiobook thing. Everyone told me not to do it, and it's like there's no like big fee associated with it. It's like a tiny little day player thing. Yeah,
well, it's great that you did that then, just to do it.
I did it because it felt very personal, and even though everyone was like, "It takes forever, don't do it," there's no reason for you to do it. The book had been my baby for so many years.
Is that 5 years writing this?
Yeah.
Wow.
And even though obviously the actual writing part of it was concentrated towards the end and then rewriting because people get fired every 5 minutes, as I was just saying.
Yeah, the book reads so current. I was telling you earlier, like when you were talking about Tillerson being fired, I'm used to reading that online, on Twitter. It was weird to be holding a physical book and reading about Tillerson being fired.
Yeah.
It's like, how did this get in here?
Right.
That just happened.
Yeah.
When you were
I'm glad it did, because it was really like there were big fights at the last minute. Like, it is worth it. Put it in.
Did you think about waiting until Pompeo started? Or do you just have to draw the line at a certain point? Just get the book out.
Well, this is the problem with book timetables. You can't just say, like a magazine piece, like, okay, we'll run it the next day. It's locked in. And the promo schedule is locked in. And there's all these people working around the clock, you know, uh-huh. and all these different departments. And for publishing, the schedule we did was already way, way faster than the system can usually accommodate. You have the text all locked and put to bed, you know, in the spring, and then you publish a book in the fall. I was still finalizing the text in, you know, February, March, and then we published in April.
Let me end on this. Where the book kind of ends, you talk a little bit about Pompeo. You talk about hope for the future, but how this kind of paring down of the State Department of diplomacy can be reversed. What's your sense from your own reporting, people you've talked to, about Pompeo, and also where diplomacy now goes from here?
I leave this book reporting process with a lot of hope, because
that's interesting.
I think
that's great.
Yeah, diplomats are a resourceful breed, and we still have great people coming into the Foreign Service, not as many as we would like, but I think that it's become enough of a rock bottom moment that Pompeo as a politician will have to recognize that he can gain a lot of plaudits just by supporting the flow of talent into that bureaucracy. And I think he'll see how politically inauspicious Rex Tillerson's tenure as the kind of hatchet man has been. And I have to hope that basic political incentives will compel a better approach this time.
Right. I said that was the last question, but there is one final thing I want to ask you. Your reporting has been so impressive through this book, through The New Yorker, all these other places. What advice do you have to young reporters that are working on really hard stories that are really hard to tell and break?
Keep going. Mm-hmm. Never stop reporting. There was a point at the end of my reporting process for what was to be a television piece at the time, and at the beginning of my process for The New Yorker, where I was kind of not under the auspices of any news organization, and I was fielding a lot of attacks, and it was quite scary. And I remember my now editor at The New Yorker, a wonderful woman named Deirdre Foley Mendelson, who's brilliant, saying to me, "You never stop reporting." Mm-hmm. And, you know, I went and paid for crews out of pocket and did whatever it took. And, you know, then I had the backing of The New Yorker. But that phrase has stuck with me.
Yeah.
Well, don't stop.
It's fantastic work. It's fantastic advice.
Thank you
so much for being here. Congratulations on everything. I know you're incredibly busy, so I will let you go break the next thing.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Thanks, Ronan.
Want more Late Night with Seth Meyers? Be sure to follow the handle at Late Night Seth on Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, and Snapchat. You can also watch full episodes of Late Night at LateNightSeth.com or on the NBC app. And please tell your friends who are fans of Seth Meyers to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes.
Business can mean a lot of things. For some, it's earning reports, the top MBA program, investments. But business isn't everything we do. Side hustles that explode into the next billion-dollar company.
I need to create my own product that I control what the marketing is for.
Unconventional ideas that change the world we live in.
AI is everywhere, with venture capital pouring in.
From Elon Musk,
he took a massive axe and swung it through Twitter's workforce.
To Taylor Swift,
she is unstoppable as her Eras Tour stimulated local economy.
Your favorite coffee shop down the street to the vacation house you rented last weekend. Whatever business means to you, Wondery is the destination for business podcasts. Listen to top business shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Everything from top daily news.
There was more ranch dressing sold last year than ketchup and barbecue sauce.
We're buying the dip, literally.
To deep dives on the biggest successes and failures of our time.
20,000 people lost their jobs.
Wondery means business.